Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio. I'm Michael Harris, and my special guest today is Dr. Craig Malkin. He is a, I'm looking at your promo, and I'm, of course not, there it is. You are Harvard Medical, Chief Medical Psychologist of Harvard Medical School. I actually found you on Huffington Post as a blogger, and you have a new book, and it is called Rethinking Narcissism. And welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael. It's nice to be on.
I'm just going to throw you into the deep end of the pool. I'm sorry about the crackle in your ears, listeners, but we're going to press on because this is internet radio. Let's talk about what is narcissism.
Yeah, first we have to talk about what it isn't, because I would guarantee that if I was sitting in a room with anyone listening, and I asked them to think about narcissism and narcissists, the image they would have is a vain, preening, primping, boastful braggart, a reality TV type. And the problem with that image is that it's a stereotype of narcissism and narcissists. Not all narcissists care about looks or fame or money, and some can be extremely quiet, but might pride themselves on being the most helpful person in the room. So if we get too focused on that idea of what narcissism is and who narcissists are, we miss signs of trouble. In Rethinking Narcissism, I try to lay out in very clear terms. I even have 5 early warning signs. Hopefully we can get to a couple of them. And other templates, really, for people understanding. I try to lay it out very clearly so people can spot trouble that doesn't involve somebody spending too much time in a mirror. So I'm going to take this in pieces. I will answer your question, what is narcissism, but I think we have to start there.
Okay. And obviously there are different kinds, but just for the benefit of the listeners, what are the different kinds of narcissism?
So this leads into the rest of it. So as I said, you know, I spend the first 3/4 of the book helping people understand bad narcissism, because we have a lot of misconceptions. Again, we have that stereotype. We also know from the research that there's something called healthy narcissism. It sounds like an oxymoron, but it's been introduced since the beginning of our understanding of what narcissism is. And it turns out that in a quarter century of research or more, really, including my own that I've done with my colleagues, shows that the vast majority of people around the world feel a little bit special. They see themselves as slightly exceptional or unique, and that helps us when we feel that way. People who view themselves through slightly rose-colored glasses feel more optimistic, more resilient. They're able to persist in the face of failure, enjoy big dreams. They might even live longer because it tends to lower cortisol, the stress hormone, which is, helps, you know, when we have lower cortisol, we're less prone to illness and disease. So that is healthy narcissism. You can think of that as one type. And the best way to think about it, coming back to the question of what is narcissism, is because of this, we really want to think of narcissism as a pervasive human drive, the drive to feel special, slightly exceptional or unique. And narcissists, and we can talk about why this happens, are people who are addicted to feeling special. They use it kind of like a drug to soothe themselves, the same way an alcoholic might turn to wine or liquor to feel better. Narcissists use feeling special. And, of course, that means there are many different kinds of narcissism. We know this from the research. At the time I was writing Rethinking Narcissism, we had healthy narcissism and unhealthy narcissism, 2 or 3 different kinds of unhealthy, no way to unite them all. And I wanted to describe what they all have in common. So it's this addiction to feeling special. But you can have extroverted narcissists who pride themselves on being the best-looking or the smartest person in the room, and they like to ascend the stage. You can have introverted narcissists who are quiet. I mentioned this earlier. Who could care less about looks, who might spend no time, in fact, looking at themselves in the mirror. But they respond to slights more easily, and they agree with statements like I'm a particularly sensitive person. You know, they're the kind of person who you're talking to them and they say, what do you mean by that? And they sort of catch any little moment where they feel like somehow you're not paying perfect attention or getting what they're saying. That's more introverted narcissism. And there's even something called communal narcissists. Communal narcissists agree with statements like, one day I'll be known, the world will know me for the good deeds I have done. Obviously, someone who could care less about looks or money, they want to be known as the most helpful person on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So all kinds of ways to feel special, all kinds of ways to feel addicted to it, which is why we have these different phases of narcissists.
Okay. Here's an interesting question. Just kind of popped into my head, and we didn't talk about it before the show, so I'm not trying to throw you into the deep into the pool, but it just occurred. If you think about the Disney movies, you know, with the popularity of all the little Disney movies with all the little princesses and stuff, are we creating a generation or several generations of narcissistic girls that think that they have to be a princess?
No, because I don't flat no, because I don't think that's what causes unhealthy narcissism or people to become extremely narcissistic. There's that common idea. It was floated in the book by Jean Twenge and her co-author Keith Campbell, the narcissism epidemic, for example, that we have an epidemic of narcissism. And that was cited as one of the reasons the T-shirts that say princess. And I'm going to cite a contrasting example. The movie A Little Princess, in the book A Little Princess, there's this girl who is separated from her father. She thinks he's dead. She winds up in a house. The woman who's caring for her is talking to her. And she talks. The little girl sort of lets on that she likes to, that she thinks she's a princess, or her daughter, her father told her this. And the woman says, "You're not a princess." And the little girl says, "But all daughters are princesses, whether they're pretty or ugly, whether they're tall or short, whether they're fat or thin, whether they're dressed in rags. Didn't your father tell you that? Didn't he?" It's a very moving moment, and that sort of kept her going. What it captures is that it's not telling our kids that they're special that makes them extremely narcissistic. And this is clear from the research, and our own and others at this point, and I can get into those details if we have time, but just the headline is that it's our capacity when we're sad or lonely or scared or we have needs, to turn to others who we think of as special, and either one or more people that we think of as special, parents in this situation, and trust that they will be there for us in our time of need, that they have our back. Something in research called secure attachment. And extremely narcissistic people don't have that. So the kind of parenting that we want to focus on is the kind of parenting that promotes secure attachment. It has nothing to do with whether or not kids are called princesses or princes or whether they're given participation trophies. That by itself is not going to make somebody narcissistic. And actually now there's direct research confirming not only that, there's direct research that shows that the idea of a narcissism epidemic among millennials is better explained by rampant stereotyping than it is by the actual research.
All right. So and let's just kind of recap for a second. What is the difference between healthy narcissism? How do we differentiate between healthy narcissism and unhealthy narcissism?
We can even talk about disorder here. The difference is, so healthy narcissism, remember, there's some evidence, just because of the cross-cultural pervasiveness of it, that it might be wired into us. This, when you think about it, it makes sense, this drive to want to stand out from the other 7 billion people on the planet, just a little bit. because nobody wants to feel like they're nothing. They want to feel special to at least somebody that they love, again, like a parent or a partner. So when we feel like when we see ourselves through the slightly rose-colored glasses, it's not just self-esteem, and it's not an accurate self-image. It's slightly inflated, and when we have that, just enough of it, that is healthy narcissism, enough to help us feel resilient and optimistic and happy, and to have mutually loving relationships. In fact, part of healthy narcissism is seeing our partners through slightly rose-colored glasses. Again, this is mm-hmm. all a part of the new science of spotting and coping with narcissists, that more and more measures, including our own, are factoring in healthy and untangling healthy from unhealthy narcissism. As I mentioned earlier, to me, the best way to understand this is that narcissists, and particularly disordered narcissists, become addicted to feeling special, so much so that they set aside all their considerations. Other people's needs and feelings, for example, become less important. However they can feel special, whether it's by feeling like the most altruistic person you've ever met or the most beautiful person you've ever met. And instead of being open about when they are sad or lonely or scared or uncomfortable and being able to admit to those vulnerable feelings, and turn to someone with them and depend on people, they depend on feeling special instead. When it becomes so severe that they set aside everything, just like any extremely addicted person, the world sort of falls away. Nothing else matters than getting the high. And people with narcissistic personality disorder, for example, it becomes so strong that they show a pattern that I call triple E, which is a pervasive pattern of exploiting people to get their needs met, doing whatever it takes in order to feel better about themselves or get their needs met, entitlement, acting like the world or other people owe them. In fact, that combination of exploitation and entitlement has been determined to be the core of unhealthy narcissism, called EE in the research. But I add triple E to understand narcissistic personality disorder. You get enough of that so that you become basically deaf and blind to what other people need and feel, then you become empathy impaired too. You can't put yourself in other people's shoes. So triple E is the hallmark: exploitation, entitlement, empathy, dysfunction, or impairment. That is the hallmark of disordered narcissism. So whenever you start to see entitlement starting to go up and exploitation, that is when people are becoming more and more dependent on or addicted to feeling special. That, to me, is the definition of unhealthy narcissism.
Okay, one of the people on my flash chat said our voices are echoing. I'm sorry, I can't do anything about the line without hanging up and starting over. And Dr. Craig's way too busy for us to start over.
Oh gosh, I'm sorry to hear that.
We'll just work through it. And this triple E is really, really interesting, sir. This goes into one of the next questions that I have is when you're differentiating between narcissism and sociopathic behavior, where's kind of the borderline? Is the boundary pretty much in the empathy component?
It definitely is. But one thing people should know is that it's clear from the research that narcissism and psychopathy are moderately related. They're not perfectly related. So just because you are extremely narcissistic doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be psychopathic. But built into the definition of psychopathy is narcissism. Psychopaths are inherently egotistical and care only about themselves. The difference, psychopathy is an aspect, an important core aspect of sociopathy. These used to be synonymous. When sociopath is really somebody who engages in overt criminal behavior. They might have even been arrested. Mm-hmm. Think of Tony Soprano, right, mm-hmm. from the series The Sopranos, or Walter White more recently from Breaking Bad. This is sociopathy. Mm-hmm. But the difference is that if you look at the research, we used to think of narcissists had zero empathy, but it turns out that if you're just looking at people who are purely narcissistic, high in unhealthy narcissism and nothing else, they are blocked in empathy. In fact, there are a number of experiments now, 12 or so, where people can be induced, not just in a laboratory, but in live couple relationships, to be more empathic and to be less narcissistic. So our current understanding, and the reason the diagnosis for narcissistic personality disorder was changed from a lack of empathy to impaired empathy, is that people who struggle with unhealthy narcissism are blocked or preoccupied by their own needs, and if we can unblock them, they have the capacity for empathy. Psychopaths, especially extremely psychopathic people, it's clear from the neuroimaging research, they don't experience feelings in the same way. Mm-hmm. They have an absence of emotional empathy. They can act as though they understand. They can say the words, but it's sort of empty. They're going through the motions. In the show Dexter, they do a really good job of him talking about his struggle to go through the motions. That's pretty typical of somebody who's high in psychopathy. So people who just struggle with narcissism, if they don't have that piece where they're also extremely psychopathic, they can be reached and they're also capable of empathy.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite movies is Running with Scissors, with Annette Bening and the guy who they're meeting with their psychotherapist, and the psychotherapist is recommending, you know, some type of radical therapy where they meet 4 or 5 hours a day, 5 days a week, and her husband is kind of bewildered by this and goes, I can't do that. You know, one of us has to work. And she goes, see, I told you it was a narcissist. And if you get, the book is even funnier, so if you get an opportunity to read Running with Scissors, it is a crack up. But I did want to differentiate or kind of help the listeners differentiate, because the word narcissist, and the word sociopath, I mean, they fling that word out anytime that somebody says something that they don't like, they don't understand, or disagrees with their present position. How do we really, really identify a narcissistic behavior or a narcissist in our lives, and what do you do about it?
So part one, how do you identify? Again, it's not by how much time they spend in the mirror. So I can share some of the tells that I describe in detail in Rethinking Narcissism, that whether the person is a communal narcissist or whether an introverted narcissist or an extroverted narcissist, they're going to show these tells. Because remember, unhealthy narcissism is an attempt to cope with a particular kind of insecurity, insecure attachment. They are afraid of depending on others at a deep level. So they depend on feeling special instead. This is why very often in the beginning of a relationship, this is what makes it really confusing for people. This is why I really wanted to make clear, again, part of the new science of spotting and coping with narcissists is recognizing that the good and bad coexist. In the beginning of a relationship, you might see a lot of good stuff. But what happens is, as you get close to this person over time, their needs become more important. And we need a capacity to be able to say, I'm lonely, or I miss you, or I'm a little insecure in the relationship right now, and turn to people for comfort and care and support. That, again, that is what affective dependency is. It's another word for secure attachment. So narcissists can't do that when they're extremely narcissistic. They're not comfortable with it, so they dodge vulnerability. And that is what gives them away. We all do this from time to time, when we feel insecure, but narcissists do it always, almost always, and in some way to feel superior. That's the difference. So a good example is something I call emotion phobia. Precisely because they are uncomfortable saying they feel vulnerable in some way, I'm scared, I'm sad, or lonely, especially over time, narcissists often shut down or become angry when they have an intense need or they are feeling vulnerable. But more importantly, if you're speaking to them, they might shut the conversation down when you're trying to share more difficult feelings, not necessarily about them. So I had a client whose girlfriend, when every time he tried to talk about how afraid he was of losing his job or you know, his mother was struggling with breast cancer at one point, as another example, she would literally start cleaning. That was how uncomfortable she was with even experiencing his feelings of his vulnerability vicariously. And another way this often comes up, I'm sure people have run into this if they're listening. This is the person that you're talking to and say, boy, I had a really bad day with my kids. It was just really hard. I wound up in tears. I was so upset trying to deal with them. And the person you're speaking to says, I don't know what you mean. I've never felt that way. That is a way of feeling superior, right? Like, who would feel that way? That's just strange that you would have such feelings. That's a good example of emotion phobia.
Okay, so like complete
so that is one tell that obviously has nothing to do with vanity.
Mm-hmm.
And it has everything to do with trying to avoid vulnerability.
Well, we've got about 8 minutes, sir. And one thing I definitely wanted to get into is, and I apologize for asking you back-to-back questions, but can these people become healthy and change? And which would be, and part B of the question would be, what do you do if you can't leave? Like you know, you have kids and a mortgage, and you know, you need two incomes to maintain your life. What do you do?
Yeah, people who are extremely narcissistic. Part one: people who are extremely narcissistic can change. We know that from the research. Even spontaneously, people with narcissistic personality disorder, in a large scale study following people over time, tend often age out of the diagnosis because they have these corrective life experiences, they're called, where they hit rock bottom. These are the people who call us therapists up and they say, I feel like I've ruined my life. I feel like I've ruined my relationships. They're obviously going to be ready to change. But even couples, when they come in, the first thing you have to look for is the three stop signs. We haven't talked about three stop signs, have we?
No, not yet.
Yeah, okay, so you need to look out for the three stop signs. And the three stop signs, it's like if you're to make sure that you can even have a hope for anything changing in a relationship, I'll just go through them quickly since we're short on time. Emotional or physical abuse. Not all narcissists are abusive, but some are, and some are even physically and emotionally abusive. And if there's ongoing emotional, physical abuse in a relationship, it doesn't matter whether it's caused by alcohol or any gambling or, you know, bipolar disorder, whatever, the abuse needs to stop first. And your question shouldn't be, can this relationship get better until the abuse stops? That needs to go first. Denial is another stop sign. By stop signs, I mean reasons to figure out help, what are my next steps, and they might be leaving the relationship or getting help leaving. Denial of any kind, if somebody can deny that they have a gambling problem or an alcohol addiction, they're not going to get better. Same is true of somebody who struggles with narcissism. And psychopathy we already touched on. Extremely psychopathic people, when you have psychopathic narcissists, are also called malignant narcissists. And I have very little hope for a relationship with a malignant narcissist. They're often the ones who tend to be the most abusive, too. Those three stop signs, and really you want to get help figuring out next steps with a professional. I want to make this very clear to listeners, and I make it very clear in Rethinking Narcissism. But if you don't see those signs, yes, there's a chance for help, but you need a couples therapist who will, or an individual therapist too, who's working with this person you really roll up your sleeves. And the goal has to be to help them recognize the way they dodge feelings of vulnerability. Because what they need to unblock their empathy, they need to learn to be able to say, I'm scared, I'm sad, I'm lonely, in an open and genuine fashion, and test out depending on people. And there are ways that I lay out, we're not going to get a chance to do it, just based on the research on what reduces narcissism and all the most effective couples therapies that we have today. I pull that all together and I just put together these templates for testing out so that you don't have to try to struggle with the question, is this person, can I deal with them for, or, you know, can I stay in this relationship? You don't have to struggle wringing your hands for months or years, but within a matter of weeks you can have an answer to that question by just using these simple strategies. If the answer becomes back no and you've left the relationship, or you're co-parenting with someone, I recommend something called a connection contract. Is it okay if we go on, or should we take a little breather?
Oh, absolutely. What's going to happen in 3 minutes is we're going to go off the live feed, and I've got another 15 for the podcast, but let's keep going.
Okay. All right. So a connection contract is where you lay out in explicit detail exactly the behaviors that are unacceptable to you to the person ahead of time. So say you're co-parenting with someone, you have to sit and talk about visitation schedule. They're extremely narcissistic. They're only going to get worse after divorce. Everybody gets more narcissistic after a divorce, right? Because you get angry and you want to defend your position. The more narcissistic someone is before, the worse they're going to be after. So now you're dealing with you could be dealing with a hellacious situation. What you want to say is, listen, I'm happy to talk about visitation with you, but if your voice goes up, if I hear you raise your voice, if I hear accusations or if I hear you call me names, that will tell me that you're not in the space to have the conversation, and we'll have to pick it up at a later date. So it's up to you whether or not we're able to talk about this tomorrow. If I see those signs, it's going to tell me I'm not safe to stay in the conversation. Now, the advantage of this is nobody likes to have their behavior predicted. So 9 times out of 10, when you do this, even with a narcissistic person, they might grumble or say, what are you talking about? But then they kind of are on best behavior when you see them.
Mm-hmm.
And you've said it ahead of time. You've laid out. It's a connection contract because what you're doing is you're giving the conditions for whether or not you're willing to stay present. Because if it's gotten to this point, your presence is as much as you should promise, nothing more. And all you're asking for are them to say, not call you names or be abusive or just behave inappropriately if they want you to be a part of the conversation. That's a connection contract.
Excellent. So do you want to tell any stories? I said, do you want to tell any stories? What is your favorite success story?
Success story? Can you repeat the question, Michael?
Yes, sir. What is your favorite success story?
Success story.
Yes, sir.
Am I getting that?
Yes, sir.
Okay, excellent. My favorite success story was I worked with one man who was extremely narcissistic for years. Obviously, I'm going to be disguising and doing composites, so this will be sort of a blend of different experiences I've had. That's what I do in the book, too. But I worked with one person for years, and he often coped with drugs. He would get drunk. He would black out. But one of his main problems was that anytime he got anywhere close in a relationship with a woman, he would immediately start getting arrogant. He would compare her to other, whoever he was dating, to other women. This was all a way of distancing. And I worked with him very closely because he said, I blow up at every relationship and I don't know why. And I was like, I think I know why. And but you know, I rarely tell people you're extremely narcissistic or tell them they have any disorder. I tend not to talk about that. I want to focus on the behaviors and what drives them and changing the behavior. So in his case, we worked very closely together to show him that he was terrified of vulnerability, and that all of these ways, in particular, saying and doing things to make the other person feel unsure of themselves, something I call playing emotional hot potato. That's another one of those signs in a relationship. I don't want to feel this way. Here, you take it. And the person says and does things to make them feel less sure of themselves. That's one of the things he did. We went through the list, and I pointed out for true change to happen, we have to be able to get to these feelings. That's when we're working. And we went through the list and identified all of these ways that he would dodge moments of vulnerability, and why that led to his, say, being arrogant with people and alienating them, and often, even in his conversations with me, saying things that sounded condescending. And anyway, we worked together for years, and a few months ago I get back an email, and he made progress. And in fact, the last time I was with him, he had been in a relationship. He had to move away. He had been in a relationship for something like 3 months, and was catching himself in these moments where he was relying on his old narcissistic habits of coping. And I got an email, I would say a few months ago, where he said, just thanking me that he thinks about the work that we did, and that I taught him to love, and he's getting married.
That's awesome.
That's my favorite success story.
That is awesome. We're on the podcast, so it's just you and me.
Right.
But I thought we'd take a little turn in the road, because interpersonal or intimate relationships are not the only incident where you're going to encounter narcissism. Is your advice in the book, and I apologize, I haven't read the book, is your advice and direction different if you're experiencing narcissism in the workplace or in a family unit in which you are not intimate?
It does differ, because your goal in an intimate relationship, your goal when you're in a love relationship, is to see if the person can open up to empathy and have this capacity to depend on you, for the two of you to depend on one another in a mutual, authentic fashion. Again, that's secure attachment. You're not looking for secure attachment in the workplace. Very often, you might be in a family, so let's just talk about the workplace. So you're not going to get to this depth of feeling. So I actually, in rethinking narcissism, I also lay out templates for how to deal with people, narcissistic coworkers and bosses. And in the book, I say, if you're having trouble in a relationship and you don't think you can really be close to this person anymore, whether it's a parent or whether it's a partner, go to the workplace chapter, because those are the techniques you should use. Because it's about management, it's not about getting close. Exact same thing. If you're trying to manage a relationship at work, it's the same as managing a relationship in your family or managing a relationship with an ex. So, for example, in the workplace, one of the things that I recommend is something I call catching good. There's this standard recommendation people have that if your boss is narcissistic, for example, stroke their ego. Well, that's terrible advice. In fact, now there's research that shows, not surprisingly, if you stroke somebody's ego, they just become more narcissistic. Big surprise there. There are some other don'ts. Don't avoid somebody simply, especially a boss, because they're behaving in ways they're arrogant or they're sort of making you feel insecure. That tends to make them feel more unsure of themselves, and then they become more narcissistic too. And also, especially if they're in a power position, don't confront them with what a jerk they are. you risk your job, or even with a coworker. And again, the rule of thumb you have to have here is if it doesn't work with somebody who's not narcissistic, it's not going to work with a narcissist. So how well does it work on any of us if you say, you know what, you're being an asshole, you're being a jerk? It just doesn't work. So instead, I recommend catching good. We know from the research that even the most unhealthy, even the most extreme narcissist, somebody with NPD, has flashes of empathy. They have moments where they can show a capacity for connection and caring. Again, otherwise, people wouldn't wind up stuck with them in a relationship for years because they're focused on the good and hoping the good will stick around. And the problem is it doesn't. So they have those moments. And so, if it's a boss or a coworker, what I recommend, instead of confronting or ignoring, is to catch them in one of those moments. To say to your coworker, Dan, you know, it was so great the other day when you asked me how I was doing and you had my back when I went out to get coffee. It makes me feel like we're like on a team and I want to push even harder. Like, you've got my back and thanks so much for that. So you want to notice the moments of better behavior. And we already know from the research, this is straight out of the research on what reduces narcissism too, by the way. I won't get into the technical aspects of it, but there's, as I mentioned earlier, about a dozen studies on what reduces narcissism. And it's that focus on when people are showing more of a communal capacity, more caring, when their empathy comes out. So with a coworker, you want to catch them being good. With a family member, where you've kind of given up hope on a really close relationship, you catch them being good. At the very least, they're going to be on better behavior more often.
That's good positive behavior shaping.
Yes.
Thank you so much for being on the show. We have just touched the surface. I would love for you to come back. I know you're really busy, but... I will pester you on social media and see when I can get you to come back, because this is a great topic and it's so pervasive in our society right now. People are just like at wit's end on what to do. Why don't we tell them how to get a hold of you? Unless they're planning on going to Harvard Med and becoming one of your students. Or you being their supervisor, what would be another way that they could connect with you, get on your newsletter, and buy your book?
Yeah, so I'm at www.drcraigmalkin.com. That's drcraigmalkin as in Nancy.com. And if you go to that website, you can even click the tab for the book. And it's called The Book because the book is because Rethinking Narcissism, the Bad and Surprising Good About Feeling Special, is being translated into something like 9 languages at this point. And there's a UK version under a different title called The Narcissist Test. So it's got a different title. If you click the book, you can read more about it. You can see I have a ton of, at this point, of critical reviews from places like Psych Central and from experts in our field. People are liking the new science of spotting and coping with narcissists because it opens things up in a way that makes it a lot clearer, brings things together. So you can buy the book there, but you can also find on my website the brief version of the scale that I and my colleagues put together called the Narcissism Spectrum Scale. So you can find out where you fall in the narcissism spectrum. And it gives you research feedback and tips at the end about what you can do with your score if you score in a certain place, if you're too low, because again, if you're too low in healthy narcissism, that's a problem. People who are too low in healthy narcissism tend to be drawn into relationships with extremely narcissistic people. And what to do if you're too high, and how to nurture healthy narcissism in yourself, and all of that you get if you take the online test. But again, there's links directly on my website to purchase the book, and there's a contact tab if you would like to schedule a consultation with me. Contact me. You can contact me through there.
Excellent. Thank you so much for being on the show. I look forward to speaking with you again, but I'm just going to, we're going to close it up for today. You've been listening to the Healthy Mind and Body Radio Show. I'm Michael Harris, and my special guest has been Dr. Craig Malkin. Thank you, sir, and we will talk again soon.
Thanks so much, Michael. Thanks for having me on the show.
Have a great day.
You too. Take care.